network. This is the news. This is the network. This is the news. This is the network. Network.
I'm Tom Rowe in Accra, and you've tuned into the WGXC Morning Show, and we have a busy show for you today. We'll hear from Alex Kahn and Sophia Michalalis, who will preview the Mad Hatter's Parade May 13th in Hudson. We'll also hear from climate activists about their planned rally Saturday, April 29th in Albany at the State Teachers Union to urge their leaders to divest the state pension funds from fossil fuels. Jordan Dale of Divest NY previews the rally. We will also hear the national headline from the Public News Service and the local Better Weather from the Catskill Maker Syndicate. It all starts after Jason Martin from Troy has finished singing this song. Then it's time for the local news on the WGXC Morning Show. Stay tuned.
Turns the blood. A stream runs through. This is the network. Network. This is the news. This is the network. This is the news. This is the network. Network. This is the news. This is the network. This is the news. This is the network. Network. And the moon turns the blood. A stream runs through. And the moon turns the blood. This is the network. Network. And the moon turns the blood. A stream runs through. And the moon turns the blood. This is the network. Network. This is the news. This is the network. This is the news. This is the network. Network. This is the news.
This is Jim Sklavounis of Nick Cave and the Bad Seeds, and you're listening to 90.7 FM, WGXC, Accra.
The Catskill Town Board meets every first Tuesday of the month at 6:30 p.m. at the Catskill Town Hall and holds a committee meeting the third Wednesday of the month at 6:30 p.m. You can turn out in person at the Catskill Town Hall to speak at these meetings or tune in to a live web stream through the Catskill Town Board and WGXC. Go to wgxc.org/listen or click on the listen button at wgxc.org to tune in to any of the Catskill Town Board meetings, the first Tuesday of the month at 6:30 p.m. and the third Wednesday of the month at 6:30 p.m. at wgxc.org and townofcatskillny.gov.
WGXC underwriting support has been provided by Dedicated Presentation Solutions. Allow DPS to turn your audiovisual how-do-I's into here's-how-you-cans. Visit dedicatedpresentation.com or call 845-475-8465 for more information. Dedicated Presentation Solutions, your audiovisual partner.
WGXC is made possible in part by the generous ongoing support of Meredith Coy of Atlanta, Georgia. Sustaining supporters are among the station's most dedicated listeners. They care deeply about creative community radio, and their investment helps to sustain WGXC as a public platform for information, experimentation, and engagement in Greene and Columbia counties. You too can become a WGXC sustaining supporter by investing in community radio every month. Go to wgxc.org and click donate. Thank you for your support.
I'm Tom Rowe from Wave Farm, and this is the WGXC Daily News. For Friday, April 28th, go to the WGXC newsroom at wgxc.org for more information about any of these stories. Nick Reisman reports at New York State of Politics that Governor Kathy Hochul announced April 27th that, quote, a conceptual agreement has been reached, unquote, in negotiations on the state budget that was due April 1st. The new budget spends $229 billion with changes to the bail law and more aid for schools. The deal includes raising the minimum wage to $16 an hour in New York City and to $15 an hour north of Westchester County, with further increases indexed to the rate of inflation. There's also an expansion of the child tax credit and money for publicly financed campaigns. Schools who had to propose budgets of their own without knowing how much money they would be getting from the state will receive a record amount. Read more about this story at New York State of Politics. Brendan J. Lyons reports in the Times Union that three Rensselaer County government officials have been indicted on federal criminal charges of using fraud and intimidation to obtain absentee ballots in the names of voters for primary and general elections in 2021. Richard W. Christ, the county director of operations, is one of the three indicted. James R. Gordon, director of the county's Bureau of Central Services, and Leslie A. Wallace, a longtime political consultant listed in public records as, quote, an assistant for constituent relations, unquote, in the office of Rensselaer County Executive Steve McLaughlin, were the other two indicted after turning themselves in to the FBI's Albany headquarters on April 27th. They all entered not guilty pleas. They were released on the condition that they do not travel outside the United States. U.S. Magistrate Judge Andrew T. Baxter warned them against trying to influence or intimidate any witnesses. The indictments alleged that the trio conspired to use their official positions to violate the constitutional rights of county employees under them, intimidating them into requesting and filing absentee ballots. They each face up to 10 years in prison if convicted of conspiracy to violate constitutional rights, while Gordon faces up to 20 years in prison for witness tampering, and Wallace could get 5 years in prison for making false statements. Read more about this story in the Times Union. Nancy Kern reports for Columbia Green Media that Greenville voters must decide whether to approve a proposed $34 million, $227,771 school budget for next year at the May 16th election. The proposed budget is $530,329 larger than last year, with a 2.47% increase in the property tax levy. The plan includes opening the school's fitness room to the community 2 evenings a week. The story does not itemize what programs are getting funding increases and which are getting cuts. Residents in the Greenville Central School District vote on the annual spending plan from 1 to 9 p.m. May 16th in the Scott M. Ellis Elementary School cafeteria. Read more about this story at HudsonValley360.com. And Jane Kaufman reports in the Berkshire Eagle that spring is here, and local bears have ended their hibernation. In Massachusetts in the 1970s, there were only an estimated 100 bears, while now there are an estimated 4,500. So they will inevitably come into contact with humans. To make their visits less frequent, experts urge homeowners to remove bird feeders and pet food from outside homes and store trash indoors until the morning it is taken away. The Massachusetts Division of Fisheries and Wildlife also recommends cleaning grills, double bagging trash or sprinkling trash with ammonia to reduce the odor, and keeping meat scraps out of compost piles. And anyone with orchards, chickens, or beehives should install electric fencing to deter bears. Read more about this story in the Berkshire Eagle. And read more about any of these stories in the WGXC newsroom at wgxc.org.
Hello, and welcome to the better weather for Friday, April 28th. Local early morning temperatures range from 31 degrees in Steventown to 41 in Skodak. Regional average soil temperature is 49 degrees. Pollen levels are still bad. Maple, juniper, and ash being the heaviest aggressors right now. However, the coming rain is going to pull some of it out of the air, especially on Saturday. Today will be the last chance to get outside while staying dry. A high of 63 happens at 3 p.m. Winds and clouds keeping conditions cool all day. Double check those sump pumps, get the drip buckets ready, and make sure your windshield wipers are in good condition and your sprayer is topped off. After sunset, rain shows up and keeps on trucking all weekend. Tonight, temperatures fall to 46 degrees. Tomorrow, they stay there. Well, mostly. A high of 50 degrees happens at 3 p.m. Half inch of rain is expected to fall over the daylight hours. Overnight, rain lightens up a bit and we see a low of 46 again. Sunday, we see a high temperature of 61 degrees. Rain continues getting stronger in the afternoon and bringing some thunder after dark. Monday, rain should finally end by sunset and we see a high of 62. Today's tide schedule is low at 4:19 a.m., high at 10:05 a.m., low again at 5:17 p.m., and high tide once again at 11:01 p.m. Today's river temperature will be 52 degrees, and the tide strength will be very low, and expected to stay that way all weekend. Sunset today will be at 7:35 p.m. Sunrise tomorrow will be at 5:51 a.m. Looking way up, we see there is another error in the CME detection, this time in the other direction. Looks like it missed us. Still, a chance for G1 class storms today. Solar wind speed is currently 473 kilometers per second at 3.7 protons per milliliter. Radio propagation conditions are currently terrible till dark, then fair below 8 megahertz overnight. The 24-hour predicted KP index is 4, unsettled. The current sunspot number is 136, and this has been the Better Weather, brought to you by the Catskill Makers Syndicate.
No sports, no rock, no information for mindless chatter. We're your station.
Your host, Randall Martin. And you know, one of the great things about our area is that there are so many fun and interesting things to do all throughout the summer, especially here in the city of Hudson. And we're going to talk about one of those events that are coming up super soon. And this is called the Mad Hatter. It's a festival, it's a parade, it's just a great thing. And with me, I've got Sophia and Alex, and they put on this festival. They're going to tell us all about it. Sophia and Alex, how are you?
We're doing great. How are you?
Happy to be here.
Hey, so tell our audience about your event, what you guys do, and how you guys came up with this idea.
All right. Well, just really simply, the Mad Hatter's Parade is an annual community-built wearable art parade that roves along the streets of Hudson. And anyone can join. You know, we're not like doing a presentation with floats or anything like that. Anybody who wants to be in the parade, who wants to create wearable art, that could be a crazy hat, it could be an amazing costume. We've had puppets, we've had electronic contraptions, but everything is just carried by people in the parade. So we never know what to expect. And it's really just an excuse for all of the amazing creative thinkers, young and old, throughout Hudson to come together and kind of celebrate absurdity and randomness for one beautiful spring day on the streets of Hudson.
Well, you know, that's exactly what we need now in this day, a little absurdity and randomness in our days to lighten up all the world's problems that are facing us. And your event has been longstanding. I've heard of it happening. Tell us about the history and how you came up with the idea.
We started the first Mad Hatter's Parade was in 2019. So it wasn't that many years ago, but it kind of feels like a lifetime ago. So much happened since then. But we, Alex and I run a small nonprofit called Processional Arts Workshop, and we do parades, processions, sort of carnival-like events, performances in many parts of the world. And we had, and always we go and we work with the community to build a thing that makes sense for that place. And we had been thinking for a while, wouldn't it be great to do something in the Hudson Valley? We live a little bit south of Hudson. And so we started that idea and we talked to various people in Hudson. It felt like Hudson was a really great place to kind of maybe make that happen, partly because there's such a fantastic history in Hudson of manufacturing, of maker. There's lots of hat factories, and we had been thinking about a springtime event that really did feel absurd, that kind of celebrated the surreal experiences of our everyday life. So that was one part of our thinking. And the other thing that we really liked about Hudson is that there was just this, it's a city, but it's not a very big city. It's a small city, but it's also a small city that has many different communities that, kind of live side by side. But we were thinking this would be a really fun place where an opportunity for people to kind of walk together, and everyone makes their own thing, and people come at it from very different experiences. Some people might have, might be coming from the world of design and have a very developed aesthetic. And also we wanted to work specifically with teens and various youth groups to kind of bring them into this conversation too, and say, this city is yours. You can make an amazing piece of wearable art as well, and invite families, invite everyone to come in and walk together. And part of our thinking in terms of the Mad Hatter's Parade was also to have the route to, it's very simple. We just walk all together, but we try to make the route a little bit different every year.
Okay.
And to certainly go down Warren Street, which is where most of the parades are. And there's, amazing businesses that's, lots of people out, and it's a crowded street, but also go along different roads, different streets where people might not expect to see suddenly a whole bunch of people wearing crazy hats and outfits come through. And that's been this really fun experiment with the Mad Hatter's Parade, to kind of, we like to keep it a little bit mischievous and a little bit light on our feet, and just go through different, slightly different neighborhoods within Hudson, where the people in the parade can maybe feel more comfortable in one area or another, or feel like this is their street and not their street. And so we kind of get to zigzag through different places.
This is quite a twist and quite an interesting and engaging event. So this year, kind of walk me through it, because I've heard of your event, but I haven't been there. I haven't been in town to catch one of your events. So sort of give me like a bird's eye view. You're starting where, and you're going to end up where, and what, and what does this route look like?
So we start lining up right in front of the Hudson Area Library.
Okay.
And they have been a sponsor and supporter of the event from the very beginning.
Wonderful.
The first year we did it, we led, teen puppetry workshops through the library's youth programming. And so we'll line up right in front of the library, and we'll head out to Warren Street from there. We'll make a right heading down Warren Street, and we'll go all the way down to 2nd Street. And then we veer off of Warren Street at that point over to Columbia.
Okay.
And we go down through some of the residential areas, some of the public housing, all the way down to Front Street. And then we go down Front Street just a block or so. And then we end up with a grand sachet on Promenade Hill Park overlooking the waterfront.
That sounds...
We'll sort of get around the statue of St. Winifred in celebration.
That sounds
and
wonderful.
We'll also have... Oh, sorry.
No, I'm just saying I'm sorry. I was just saying that sounds wonderful. So when you get down to, are people joining you at some people might be with you as you start off, you're going from the library up 5th Street to Warren. And then do you find that people are sort of accumulating on the way, that people are kind of joining the momentum of the parade as you move forward?
Sure. It's definitely a jump in kind of parade, and people have sort of, got caught up in the momentum of what's going on. They want to know, where are all these people going? Who are they? It's very different. It's a much more nimble and, as Sophia said, mischievous parade than your typical sort of the large scale marching band parades. And so people do get caught up in the music. We've got amazing music by Brasskill and also the gamelan from Woodstock called Jam Gong. And we also have other musicians who just join in and do their own beautiful cacophony along the way. We've got some cool electronic sort of contraptions that play music. We've got a group of people who are devotees of obscure vinyl records, and they play stuff on Bluetooth speakers. So the sound really draws people in. And then, people want to know, what is this thing and where is it going? So there is a little bit of a Pied Piper effect to the Mad Hatter's Parade. But the people who have really worked hard on their hats and on their costumes, their body extensions, their puppets, generally they will, there's the core group that will meet us at the library at the very beginning because they want to be part of it from start to finish.
I imagine this is a great event for the whole family. It feels like it's a lot of fun. It feels like it's very engaging. And that's what I was thinking, as you said, the whole Pied Piper effect, that you see something that's happening that's so interesting, engaging, and welcoming, because a lot of the other parades are, and we have a lot of parades here in town, but they're pretty formatted, and you have to be, invited, and it's a whole process to be part of those. But this seems more community-centered. Is that your goal, to really have the community just feel free to engage?
100%. That's exactly it. And the more people participate and make their own costume, come join us, even if it's a small thing, if they're like, oh, well, I'm not really an artist or a hat maker, but if they come however they can and they're part of it, that makes it grow. And that is really important to us. We actually, most of our other events, we design big costumes, puppets, things, but in this case, we really don't. I mean, we bring out a few things to kind of help offer some hats to people who might have, not been planning on this and they don't want to be underdressed for the parade.
Mm-hmm,
but
mm-hmm.
Most of our work is sort of encouraging other people to come to the Mad Hatter's Parade in their own absurd regalia. And we've been working with a few groups. Perfect 10, P10 is one of the main groups those girls do incredible work. It's an after school program, and they have been with us from the beginning. And Alex mentioned the Hudson Library group that we worked with. We're working with the youth center kids, but also, so those are groups that were a little bit more organized, and so we kind of get them to do something, but we understand that sometimes this can be a little intimidating for some people who maybe don't feel, they're like, oh, I'd love to do something like that, but I don't know where to start. So for those people and anyone else who wants to join, we're running Mad Hat Slams. So these are free drop-in community workshops on the weekend before the Mad Hatter's Parade.
Okay.
Mad Hatter's Parade is Saturday, May 13th. So on the weekend before, which is May 6th and May 7th, we will be running Mad Hat Slams at the Hudson Youth Center, which is 18 South 3rd Street, from 11 in the morning to 5 p.m. So basically what that means is that Alex and I will be there. We'll have tables, tools, some basic materials, a lot of, you know, cardboard, various things. And, you know, if you want to come in and say, oh, you know, just help me get started, we'll get you started on a hat. We'll talk to you about some ideas. We'll give you some materials. We'll give you some guidance. And probably you won't be able to completely finish your hat, but you could get pretty far in starting something. And maybe you bring it home, and over the course of the week, you kind of give it its final bling and some color, whatever is needed for your hat. But that's a great opportunity for people who feel like they want to be part of it, and they just, you know, they want to be kind of part of the building community beforehand, or maybe want some help, to join us there.
I'm loving this. You know, I'm actually thinking in my mind as we're talking about how wide or tall the parameters of my hat can be during a parade. Like, what are the limitations of this, of these hats? But as we go further, and we'll find out more about the rest of the structure of the event, let's talk about you for a little bit. Tell me about how you guys got into this, some of the other events that you do, some of the work that you guys do, the artistic work and puppet making and that kind of stuff.
Sure thing. We got our start working together now about 25 years ago, when we were asked to design the opening performance for New York City's Halloween parade.
Ooh, that's big.
That's a parade that is now celebrating its 50th year, and it had always had a contingent of giant puppets lead the parade and do some kind of thematic performance. But the originator of it had moved on, and various generations of artists had come through. And so we were asked to sort of take over the design of that first section of the parade. And in that process, we opened up our studio because we were understaffed and we were on a shoestring budget. And we said, hey, we need some help building these giant Luna Moths. Can everybody come in? And here's a drawing of it. And you know, we weren't sure if anybody would turn up, but we ended up having these incredible work weekends, 30 or 40 people coming up from the city.
Mm-hmm.
And so out of that process, we realized that going into communities, saying we're going to build something together as part of this kind of understanding of a particular locality, a particular issue, a particular time and place, and working with people collectively to make those things happen, there's a certain power to that. So since then, we started a nonprofit processional arts workshop, and we travel all over the place to whatever communities might welcome us or benefit from our presence. And we sit down with them and work out things that are unique to that time and place. And then we help facilitate the construction of, you know, sometimes it's art parades or lantern processions, puppet performances and pageants, immersive experiences, you know, whatever the community in question is really calling for, whatever would fit that time and place. So we've done things, you know, in Italy, and we went to Trinidad and learned about Trinidad Carnival for a while, and have done projects in Istanbul and Kyiv. And we've also done a lot of stuff in the Hudson Valley in New York City as well, ranging from, you know, the South Bronx to Rhinebeck's Sinterklaas parade. So we're kind of all over the place. And we're, you know, what's lovely about this is that most artists sort of have to tangle with coming up with new ideas all the time. What's your newest idea? We really are more of a sounding board. You know, we go in and we listen and we respond and we try to understand what would fit for a particular community, and then we help them build it together.
Welcome to 2023 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
This country needs a rescuing. We have to rescue America from the wreckage of the Biden economy. Under my leadership, we built the greatest economy in the history of the world.
Former President Donald Trump at a campaign event in New Hampshire on Thursday hammered President Joe Biden's handling of the economy. Trump said when he left the White House, Biden was handed the fastest economic recovery with no inflation. The event follows Biden's official 2024 re-election campaign announcement earlier this week. On Thursday, the Biden administration announced initiatives to establish immigration processing centers throughout Latin America to help mitigate the number of migrants coming to the United States. Title 42 allowed the federal government to ban people from entering the U.S. due to the COVID-19 public health emergency, but that is set to expire May 11th. Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas said they will prioritize legal immigration pathways for migrants, but did call the situation a hemispheric challenge that demands hemispheric solutions.
We are building lawful pathways for people to come to the United States without resorting to the smugglers. At the same time, we are imposing consequences on those who do not use those pathways and instead irregularly migrate to our southern border.
Internal Revenue Service Commissioner Daniel Werfel spoke about IRS accountability and oversight before the House Ways and Means Committee on Thursday. Werfel's appearance comes as House Republicans passed a bill Wednesday that would cut the $80 billion in extra funding the IRS secured through the Inflation Reduction Act. Democratic Representative Mike Thompson told Werfel, while things such as customer service have improved, more work needs to be done, as his wife was on the phone with the agency for hours.
I know we have more work to do. But what worries me, Congressman, is if we reduce our funding, we'll hear more stories like
that.
FBI Director Christopher Wray spoke before a House Appropriations Subcommittee regarding Biden's 2024 budget. The president is asking $11.4 billion to go to the agency to carry out its mission. California Representative Mike Garcia still posed some concerns about how much the FBI would be allocated.
I'm concerned that the president, in a year where he is at the top line, asked for about, a 12% increase across all federal agencies, only asked for a 0.3% increase for your budget. That, to me, messages to Congress that he doesn't value the mission of the FBI, frankly.
Wray says the threats the FBI handles are more sophisticated and move more quickly than ever before. He says the requests and the budget reflect those threats. Finally, former Vice President Mike Pence testified before a federal grand jury investigating Trump's effort to overturn the 2020 election. I'm Alex Gonzalez for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our A-Trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
You're listening to the American Democracy Minute, keeping your government by and for the people. We have three follow-up stories today from California, Pennsylvania, and Nevada on the consequences of disinformation and conspiracy theories. Last week, we reported the decision by Shasta County, California supervisors to spend $950,000 on a new infrastructure to hand count ballots because they didn't trust their Dominion ballot tabulators. KRCR reports that County Supervisor Kevin Cry, who had sought election advice from MyPillow CEO Mike Lindell, was given notice of a recall petition campaign for, quote, wasting county money and bringing state and national ridicule and embarrassment to the county. Thursday's story updating investigations in Georgia and Michigan for tampering with and copying data from ballot tabulators didn't mention Fulton County, Pennsylvania, where a judge held the county in civil contempt. The Associated Press reports that two county supervisors gave access to a third party to copy 2020 voting records from Dominion tabulators in an attempt to find evidence of fraudulent voting. After Wednesday's story about harassment leading to the resignation of an entire elections department in Virginia, there's news of a bill in Nevada making it a felony to, quote, threaten to use any force, intimidation, coercion, violence, restraint, or undue influence on any election worker or voter. SB 406 passed the Senate and moves on to the Assembly. We have resources at AmericanDemocracyMinute.org. I'm Brian Beal.
You are invited to join me upon the Cypress Bough. Music from North Africa, West and Central Asia. First Monday of every month, 8 to 10 p.m. on WGXC 90.7 FM and WGXC.org.
Next, we have an interview from
WOOC.
To learn more about this program, the Sanctuary for Independent Media, visit us online at mediasanctuary.org.
We're talking today about criminal justice reform at the state capitol, and we're joined by Nick
Enchilada Malinowski with Volcker New York, and they have a pretty full agenda. So, Nick, maybe you could just start off giving us a brief overview of what is Volcker New York for the listeners, and then, you know, what are some of your key priorities this year in terms of criminal justice reform?
Sure. Thanks, Mark. Volcker New York is we're a statewide membership-based organization working to end mass incarceration, end the war on drugs, and the epidemic of HIV and AIDS and homelessness in New York State and around the country. And we do this through really organizing and mobilizing with people who are directly impacted by those issues. Again, across the state, we have bases in New York City, Capital Region, Buffalo, Rochester, and Syracuse. I work, as you kind of previewed a little bit, mostly on our mass incarceration work. And going into 2023, we really had five main legislative priorities that sort of span the gamut of the criminal legal system. So we are working on elder parole and fair and timely parole, ending qualified immunity, challenging Wrongful Conviction Act, and Daniel's Law, which would change the way that the state responds to people in a mental health crisis, specifically removing the police from that response.
Now, we're actually talking on Thursday, April 27. Still have not put that state budget to rest, and some of these issues are tied up in the budget. Now, one thing, of course, that allegedly been holding up the budget has been the governor's push to try to weaken once again the bail reforms that were passed, I guess, initially back in 2019. What's Volcker's New York sort of assessment of where the state is on this issue at the moment?
Well, the real problem, I guess, with bail in the state is that too many people are being put in jail on bails that they cannot afford. So again, the real purpose of bail historically is to provide some assurance that people come back to court. But in practice, what happens is bail is being set in amounts that people cannot afford. And so people are held in jail for weeks, months, sometimes years before they're ever convicted of anything. And often are released at the end of that, pretrial experience is the only time people are in jail. And so in 2019, when we passed bail reform, ever since then, there has been a pretty concerted effort from the right, but from police, district attorneys around the state to try and roll back that law to make it easier for people, for judges and prosecutors to hold people in jail before they've been convicted of any crime. And so we actually see that, I mean, it's a disaster that happens every year in the budget. We see a push from the executive, Cuomo, and now Hochul after him, trying to roll these really protections back for people who have been accused of a crime by the state. And so once again, we're in a situation where the governor, despite now years worth of data that the initial bail reforms had no relation to any kind of increase in crime, decades worth of data that actually incarcerating people pre-trial destabilizes people, it makes people more vulnerable to arrest in the future. Despite all this, we see the governor taking a kind of trying to get a political talking point that she's tough on crime or something, like it's the 1990s again. And so the impasse that we really have is that, the legislature is trying to stand by the data, stand by their constituents, trying to stand by the idea, the premise of the criminal legal system in the United States, that people are innocent until proven guilty. And the governor is trying to win a political talking point that really has no, is not supported by any data, around the state. So we're at this impasse now coming up to almost a month where they haven't been able to pass a budget to pave the roads, keep the lights on and things like that, because the governor is trying to win this talking point.
Now, one of the other things apparently has popped up in the budget has been the issue of discovery, basically requiring the prosecutors to turn over to the defense attorneys. Well, what exactly is the evidence we have? Is there any exculpatory evidence? And seeing from recent articles that they're talking about weakening that, I just read that the public defenders go, wait a moment, no one talked to us about this. We don't think it's a great idea to roll back this reforms. Volcker New York have any opinion on this issue?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's the way this is often covered in the media is like you described it, right, is this tension between prosecutors and public defenders. I would actually say that that's missing, I think, the point, right? Like when we're talking about discovery and evidence, what we're really talking about is what is the obligation of the state in terms of providing somebody, you know, an individual and their attorney with the evidence that the government is going to use against you in a criminal case. So it, you know, when we were working on these reforms in 2017, 2018, 2019, right, it was surprising to many people in the public at that time. There was no obligation in New York for prosecutors to hand over the evidence against you at any time before there's a trial. In New York State, 96%, I think, in New York City, it's 99% of cases never end up in a trial. It's all either dismissed or a plea bargain. And so for the vast, vast majority of cases, they're being decided without anybody seeing any evidence at all. And what this results in is, again, people having to make decisions, often monumental, life-altering decisions about whether to take a plea, how do I get out of jail, how do I get home, how do I get back to my job, how do I keep my housing, how do I keep custody of my kids, based on a prosecutor saying, well, we have some evidence against you, but we're not going to show it to you. And you're then having to make these decisions. And so really, both bail and discovery really work as a hammer for prosecutors and a tool of coercion to get people to plead guilty. Right. And obviously, if people are in jail, the violence of the jail experience, your inability to communicate with your family, to maintain your job and housing, that also is a powerful coercive motivator for just ending these cases, you know, getting some kind of finality to these cases.
Well, we only have about 3 minutes left. So I want to give you an opportunity. You mentioned there were 5 bills that you guys are really focusing upon in your package. What are the most important ones, at least? Perhaps not most important. What are the ones that seem like it might be decided this year?
Yeah, so I think, you know, all the bills that we're working on, you know, I think have a part of our analysis when we go into the year is what can we potentially pass. So, you know, the 2 parole reform bills, fair and timely parole and elder parole, we're working coalition with many groups, right, led by the RAP campaign on these bills. But that's to get elderly people out of prison, right? New York has a despite lower prison population over the last decade or so, a growing population of elderly people. You have hospices in jail. You have, you know, people living in prison with dementia, right? There's many elderly people that should not be in prison that we can start to get out now. So that's one big important piece. Ending qualified immunity. Again, we live in a society in the United States where police officers, district attorneys are not held accountable for violence against people. And so that's something that we need to address. The Challenging Wrongful Conviction Act, again, New York, one of 5 states in the country that does not provide people with an attorney in post-conviction cases. So if someone is wrongfully convicted, they have almost no way of getting back into court and having their case heard and making the case that they're innocent, right? So in New York State, it's actual innocence is not a valid legal justification for getting your case reheard around a wrongful conviction. Again, maybe surprising to folks. And then Daniel's Law. So we see in the news from around the country, in New York State, time and time again, police responding to somebody in a mental health crisis. Police are trained, you know, not to de-escalate things, but often the opposite. And so people are killed by the police in these situations. And so we're working on Daniel's Law, which was written after Rochester police killed Daniel Prude during a mental health crisis, to change that paradigm so that actually people who are trained in mental health, so that peers are responding to people in mental health crisis, so that we're reducing these fatalities, you know, between the police and people who really need care rather than, you know, guns, handcuffs, jail.
So we've been talking to Nick Encalada Malinowski from Vocal New York. Nick, if people want more information about these issues, Vocal New York, how best to do that?
Yeah, I think just check out our website. It's www.vocal-ny.org. And you can see all the issues, not just the issues that we're talking about now around mass incarceration, criminalization, but also our work on housing, drug policy, and HIV and AIDS. All there.
Thank you very much. And this has been Mark Dunley for the Hudson Mohawk Magazine. We're talking with Jordan Dale, who's a member of Divest New York, which is a statewide coalition that has coordinated a campaign initially to get the New York State Common Retirement Fund public pension plan to divest from fossil fuels, but more recently has focused their attention on the New York State teachers' retirement system, the state teachers outside of New York City. And they're doing a rally this upcoming Saturday, April 29th, quarter to 12, at the New York State United Teachers annual sort of regional assembly that's taking place there on Eagle Street at the Capitol Center. So Jordan, you know, what are you asking the teachers union to be doing?
We want the teachers union to support divestment of the teachers' retirement system. The New York State Common Retirement Fund, which is the largest pension fund in New York, has already committed to fossil fuel divestment under the leadership of Tom DiNapoli. And the New York City pension funds have already committed to divestment. And that leaves the teachers' retirement fund as the last large public pension fund in New York that remains invested in fossil fuels.
Now, I understand over the years, several dozen of the local teachers' affiliates, some retirees, have, you know, passed resolutions to support divestment. The actual state teachers' union has supported a resolution on divestment. American, Federation of Teachers, the National Teachers Involved Group, has supported divestment. So what's the problem? What's the holdup?
Yeah, I wish I understood it. The truth of the matter is that the vast majority of teachers support fossil fuel divestment. They don't want to be contributing their pension dollars to the destruction of the planet. You know, they're teaching children to so that the kids can have a good future. And at the same time, their dollars are being used to destroy their future. You know, we have a bill in the legislature, the Teachers Fossil Fuel Divestment Act. It has 86 co-sponsors, which is a lot. But we hear from some of the legislators we speak to that they're not getting a green light from the teachers union. And it's beguiling for us. It's hard for us to figure out, because there are local teachers unions that have passed resolutions in favor of divestment. The state teachers union has passed resolutions in favor of divestment. The national teachers union has passed an extraordinarily strong resolution in favor of divestment. There are no teachers unions that have passed resolutions against divestment. So what's going on? And the only thing we can conclude is that there are some wildcat leaders in the teachers union who are quietly saying, don't pass this bill. And we believe that's the holdup at this point. And so we're going to Albany to say to the various union delegates, put pressure on whoever these people are that are holding up the agenda for the planet, the agenda for their students, and the agenda for their own pension plan, because it's not just about climate destruction. It's also about protecting the teacher's pension plan. In a world where we know that we need to transition from fossil fuels to renewables in order to save the planet, in a world that's increasingly committed to that, in a state that has made landmark commitments to transitioning to renewables, it's pretty clear that the value of fossil fuels is going to decline over time. So why the New York State Teachers Retirement System insists on being invested to the tune of several billion dollars in an industry with high risk, low return is beyond me. So it's about protecting the planet, protecting the teacher's pension plan, and we want to raise teacher consciousness so that they put pressure on whoever it is in their union leadership that's slowing this process.
Now, one of the arguments you made is, or you addressed, is that, sometimes these people run the pension plans, well, we shouldn't allow, you know, social concerns to factor into our equation. But as you point out, this is actually, a bad investment. But, what do you say to, some of the pension, managers say, if we sell our stock in Exxon or Chevron or Shell, somebody else just buys it. So it doesn't really make any difference. And it's just as making a political statement that doesn't have any impact.
Well, listen, it is absolutely true that if they sell it, someone else buys it. But anybody who has ever taken the most basic course in economics understands that if there's more pressure to sell and less pressure to buy, that drives the price down. And when we drive the price down of fossil fuels, it hurts fossil fuel companies and speeds the transition. It's not just about the money, though. The fossil fuel industry is incredibly powerful. They have politicians in their pockets. They have, you know, all kinds of powerful means at their disposal to influence the general public. They engage in disinformation campaigns. They do all of this greenwashing advertising to try to convince the public that they are part of the solution, not part of the problem, but they are the problem. And when we divest from fossil fuels, it stigmatizes the fossil fuel industry, and it makes it harder for them to get away with some of the stuff that they're getting away with.
Now, since 350.org particularly, you know, started this campaign to divest various pension funds from fossil fuels, some of them public, some of them with communities of faith or a college endowment. To me, incredibly, they've been able to get more than $40 trillion worth of assets to be divested from fossil fuels. But surprisingly, among the 1,600 institutions, we've not seen particularly the public teachers actually divest. It does seem to be strange that teachers seem to be behind the eight ball in this movement. Why aren't teachers responding better? Do you have any ideas?
Mark, I don't know, but we're trying to do something about that. I appreciate your recognizing the enormity of the divestment movement at this point. 1,600 institutions throughout the world have committed to divestment, representing $40 trillion in assets, as you just said. That's a lot. And it includes some pretty incredible participants. Obviously, the New York public pension plans that I've mentioned, but also the state of Maine, the country of Ireland, Norway's Sovereign Wealth Fund, which is the largest fund in the world, Princeton and Harvard and all sorts of prestigious universities. So the divestment movement is certainly gaining momentum. And I will say that the AFT, the American Federation of Teachers, the National Teachers Union, they passed an incredible divestment resolution this past summer. That may trickle down and impact more teachers unions going forward. But, you know, let's be honest. The fossil fuel industry is very powerful. It does a lot of stuff behind the scenes. So who knows what's going on with the leadership of these unions? We know that the fossil fuel industry buys people. And I'm not making any accusations, but it makes sense for the teachers to be behind this. We believe that the vast majority of the rank and file of teachers are behind it. It's better for their pocketbooks. It's better for the planet, better for the kids they teach. And you're right to ask the question, where the hell is the union leadership in so many of these public pension plans?
So this rally is Saturday, April 29th at 11:45 outside the New York State United Teachers Representative Assembly in Albany, taking place at Capitol Center, 55 Eagle Street, right down from the Capitol. A bunch of different groups, Invest New York, POAS, Green Faith, Troy Area Labor Council, Progressive Schenectady, Green Education Legal Fund, Third Act. We've been talking to Jordan Dale, Divest New York. People want more information. Can they just show up on Saturday?
Absolutely. They can just show up on Saturday. We'll be happy to have them there. They can help hand out flyers. There will be speakers. There will be banners. We'll be doing our best to educate the representatives, the union reps who are there from throughout New York State, as well as put pressure on those union leaders, whoever they are, who've been getting in the way of climate progress.
Thank you very much, Jordan Dale, Divest New York, Saturday, April 29th at noon, a quarter to noon. And this is Mark Dunley with the Hudson Mohawk Magazine.
That interview was from
WOOC.
To learn more about this program, the Sanctuary for Independent Media, visit us online at mediasanctuary.org.
From the WGXC newsroom, this is the WGXC News Update. Nick Reisman at New York State of Politics reports that State Comptroller Tom DiNapoli said lawmakers and Governor Kathy Hochul must approve a new state budget or approve a sixth temporary extension of state spending by May 2nd. The budget was due April 1st, but lawmakers have passed five deadline extensions so far while negotiations continue. This budget is already the latest spending plan in more than a decade. The reason the budget is late is that it has become far more than just an accounting of spending and is instead full of all sorts of policy issues. Policies on housing, bail reform, charter schools, cannabis, and the minimum wage should be worked out in the legislature and passed as separate bills, but Hochul has more negotiating power with those issues in the budget. Ken Garardin, a fellow at the Empire Center for Public Policy, said lawmakers should not vote on those issues in the budget. He said, and I quote, "They don't have to vote on any of the Article 7 language that the governor has sent," end quote. Read more about this story at New York State of Politics. CNN reports that House Republicans on April 26 voted for a bill to increase the federal debt limit, but it comes with all sorts of budget cuts that mean it will not pass in the Senate. Representative Kelly Armstrong of North Dakota admitted the theatricality of the vote, saying, and I quote, "This is the first conversation. The next conversation is what comes next, and we know that this is part of the negotiation," end quote. Locally, Republicans Mark Molinaro and Elise Stefanik voted for the bill, while Democrats Pat Ryan and Paul Tonko voted against. Ryan complained on the House floor that the measure would cut funding for all discretionary programs, including Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, Meals on Wheels, Head Start, and the State Opioid Response Program, and the Department of Veterans Affairs. Ryan said, and I quote, "In New York alone, my home state, it threatens food assistance for 54,000 people and cuts preschool and child care for 17,000 kids. It puts at risk Meals on Wheels for over 1 million seniors nationwide and would cut $30 billion in support to our veterans," end quote. Read more about this story at the CNN website. Nancy Kern reports for Columbia Green Media that Greene County Tourism Director Patty Austin says tourism spending is up 44.2% in 2021, and compared to 2019, it was up 122.6%. Austin said, and I quote, "After COVID, we found that everybody just wanted wide open spaces. Because of COVID, the family institution is going strong again. People learn to live with each other, to get along with each other, and appreciate their families. Also, our hipsters want the experiential stay. They're looking for glamping," end quote. Mountain Keeper Program Director Catherine Nadeau said the number of Catskill Park visitors more than doubled from 2018 to 2021. Austin said Greene County is no longer marketing itself as Greene County, but as, and I quote, "the Catskills," end quote, in a new travel guide. Austin also said, and I quote, "Cairo is coming back. East Durham is thriving. Resorts are booming. On Main Street in Catskill, four new businesses have just opened. The department will also run video campaigns on social media platforms such as TikTok and Instagram. The marketing plan is called," and I quote, "It happens here," end quote. Read more about this story at HudsonValley360.com. Governor Kathy Hochul announced April 25th $42 million in grants for small and mid-sized capital projects for nonprofit arts and cultural